The Justice Department has its eye on BP.
Just in case the oil company was thinking it might get a little help from, say, Abu Dhabi?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, July 7th. If you thought oil companies get to do whatever they want in the U.S., think again. The Justice Department wants BP to keep it informed of future plans.
Could FM radio's days be numbered? And Disney brought you a mute mouse and a mumbling duck, so now it's bringing English lessons to China.
Of course.
Yeah, but first.
It's 10 o'clock. Do you know where BP is? The Justice Department is working on that. It's asked the oil giant for advanced warning of any plans it makes that would impact the company's future, things like signing a deal with foreign investors. The BBC's Rebecca Singer has more.
As if BP didn't have enough on its plate, it's now got the US Attorney General breathing down its neck. And a report in today's Financial Times says the news shows just how closely the Obama administration is watching the oil giant's every move. But Justin Urquhart Stewart, a fund manager with Seven Investment Management, is unsettled by it.
In the land of the free, this is most unusual to actually see this sort of direct intervention. This is not a commercial problem for BP anymore. It is a political world they're now in.
BP hasn't yet responded to the letter, but with the possibility of billion-dollar fines and being stripped of drilling permits, industry insiders think BP will agree to the request. At the moment, though, its chief executive is travelling the world. He's just landed in Abu Dhabi, one of BP's main partners in the Middle East, and a trip the US government is no doubt keeping a very close eye on. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
President Obama says he wants to double exports. To do that, he's appointing 18 company heads to serve on a U.S. Export Council, including the CEOs of Ford and Disney. The president says it will help the U.S. double exports in the next 5 years. Richard DeKayser is chief economist at Woodley Park Research in Washington. He joins us live. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
Richard, Obama says he's focusing on exports because they will create jobs. Is that true?
Well, sure it is. There's a rule of thumb that for each $1 billion of exports, we get about 7,000 jobs. So to any extent that we can grow those numbers, that will certainly go to the bottom line, so to speak.
Is it realistic to double our exports in 5 years?
It's a bit of a stretch. I was just checking my own math, and my own forecasts go out that far and show about a 70 to 80% increase in exports. So doubling would be a stretch, but like most councils organized to pursue lofty goals, a little bit of a stretch probably makes sense. And it's important to remember that the rest of the world has been and will continue to be growing more rapidly than the United States. So trying to hitch onto that growth definitely makes sense in terms of boosting our overall economic performance.
Another interesting bit of news out this morning, the EU has just voted to cap bankers' bonuses for the next year. There's, of course, been some noise about doing that same thing in this country as well. Is that a good idea?
The general concept of better aligning compensation in the banking industry with risk-taking is a fabulous idea, and we learned that lesson the hard way over the past several years. But the EU proposal goes a little bit far. It's very explicit, has very precise figures which do run a risk. They could chase workers out of the banking industry into what we've now called the shadow banking industry, which has mushroomed tremendously as regulations have overwhelmingly focused on banks, and hence we've seen the explosion in hedge funds, private equity firms, and all sorts of conduits that have been much more difficult to track. And doing this will actually encourage that migration out of the banking industry.
Richard DeKayser is chief economist at Woodley Park Research. Thanks, Richard.
My pleasure.
Listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Apple today confirmed a rogue developer managed to infiltrate its iTunes application store. The scheme included creating fraudulent purchases of e-books. At one point, 42 of the top 50 sales spots in the book category were filled with this thief's bogus works. Porter Bibb is managing director at Media Tech Capital Partners. He's with us live from New York this morning. Welcome to the program, sir.
Great to be here, Steve.
So Apple, what did this guy do?
Well, he's a Vietnamese, Duan Nguyen, a Vietnamese app developer who has put a whole slew of apps up on the Apple Store. And basically, he did this as a money-making venture.
Now, how common is this?
It's more common than anybody would ever suspect, and it's particularly common. Hacking Apple, which is notoriously weak on security, is very, very widespread.
Apple, Porter says, this is a pretty small thing. Is it? Do you agree with that?
I think Apple's being very defensive. They're saying it's not a security problem. It's a credit card problem. Call your bank. Change your credit card number, your PIN, your password, your security questions. Don't complain to us. But it's a serious lapse of security on Apple's part.
Is this just another thing when you're putting out your credit card? Now, just another way that thieves can sort of get into your personal identity? I mean, how can we be protected from this?
There are ways, but you have to build the security hurdles into the software, and Apple has failed to do that. Other stores, the wireless telecoms, most of their stores, and a lot of the online e-commerce stores have very secure credit card defenses. Apple does not, and this is a multi-million-dollar fraud that this one guy in Vietnam has created, and Apple is being very blithe in passing it off as a bank credit card problem.
And these are just small charges that most people just don't notice, right?
Well, he put these little apps, Vietnamese cartoons, mangas, they call them, for your iPhone, and he charged $4.99 each, and he stole hundreds of thousands of credit card data and charged $4.99 to each of them. You would never notice $4.99 on your – you'd think it's probably a credit card charge and just let it go. But estimates are that he took in – it's been going on since early May, and he's probably taken in more than $1 million, maybe as much as $2 million in app fees that he got from Apple for people's downloading these applications.
Porter.
But they didn't download them. He just charged them.
He just charged them to credit cards. Interesting.
Yeah.
Porter Bibb at Media Tech Capital Partners in New York. Thank you, sir, for your time.
It's always a pleasure.
In Britain, officials say tomorrow the government will announce a scheduled shift to digital radio by 2015, which means all FM tuners across the UK will go silent. It's similar to the digital television transition the U.S. went through last year, but as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London, the switch may be a little tougher when it comes to the radio.
British TV broadcasts have been switching to digital. Within 5 years, British radio will do the same. If the government gets its way, most FM and AM broadcasts here will come to an end. 100 million analog radio sets will become obsolete. The government says that digital transmissions offer more stations and higher sound quality. But critics say the switchover will cause an uproar. The cost of converting more than 20 million car radios will be horrific, says science writer Barry Fox. He claims the government has blundered.
They have not fully appreciated what the industry calls the elephant in the room, which is this vast number of vehicles on the road that would fall silent if they switch from analog to digital.
A leading British politician has warned the switchover could trigger an explosion of indignation, and he's urging the government to reconsider the plan. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Television and radio powerhouse Glenn Beck already has a conservative cottage industry. Now he wants to be an educator as well. He's launching an online university today. From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman explains.
So you have the hammer and the sickle. You have the artwork to Mussolini there here in New York.
That's Glenn Beck on Fox News giving a lesson on communist motifs hidden in New York landmarks. Beck won't deliver the lectures in his new online university. He's left that to a conservative activist, a business consultant, and a constitutional scholar. To enroll in classes like Faith and Hope 101, you sign up for premium content on Beck's website at $6.25 a month. And that term university, it's kind of a stretch.
Well, I think that Mr. Beck can call it whatever he wants.
Donald Heller directs the Center for the Study of Higher Education at Penn State.
There are certainly consumer laws with respect to if he claims he wants to offer degrees or credit or anything like that, but there's certainly nothing preventing him from calling a university if he so chooses.
Education officials in New York recently slammed Donald Trump for using the word university for his online classes. They promised to teach the art of billion-dollar deal-making, so he changed the name to the Trump Entrepreneur Initiative. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, July 7th. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith. For the latest look at the markets, go to thenumbers@marketplace.org. Adults aren't the only ones feeling the hardship of the recession. A study out today finds that when a parent loses a job, kids lose their health coverage. April Domboski reports.
For every 1,000 jobs lost, more than 300 privately insured children lose their health coverage. That's according to a new report in this month's issue of Health Affairs. Jerry Fairbrother led the study at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. She said many of these children are eligible for federal health insurance programs like Medicaid. The problem is, parents aren't signing them up.
Possibly the families are less familiar with the public assistance programs and the rules.
Many states have tried to remove disincentives to enrollment, like waiting periods, complicated forms, and burdensome proof of income requirements. But these days, with so many cuts to state budgets, families can be confused about what's available. Jocelyn Geyer directs the Center for Children and Families at Georgetown.
Once word gets out on the street that there are cutbacks, it creates enormous upheaval in an outreach effort.
Researchers hope their findings will inspire more aggressive awareness campaigns. I'm April Domboski for Marketplace.
A recent study from Yale's Rudd Center for Food Policy found kids think food tastes better when cartoon characters are on the packaging. It's part of many studies in the way food is marketed to children. LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus offers up his own modest proposal for the obesity epidemic. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
So, David, you had a solution to the obesity epidemic that you proposed in your LA Times column last week. What was that?
It's pretty simple, actually. Let's substitute tobacco for junk food when we think about regulation. And by that, what I mean is we already have very effective measures to address the tobacco problem. And in fact, we've brought the smoking rate down from nearly 50% among adults to 20% because of these steps that we take. All I'm saying is apply the same thinking to junk food, and maybe you can bring the obesity rate down as well.
And what reaction did you get for this proposal?
Well, the phrase food Nazi has resonated a number of times in my email box, and also communist, socialist. People feel very strongly when you tell them what can and can't go into their mouths. But that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying you ban sugary beverages. I'm just saying if you treat it like tobacco, you will disincentivize. Not only will you limit the marketing, limit the sponsorships, and hopefully limit the access that kids will have to a lot of this, because health experts say it's all about the external cues. If you are exposed to external cues to eat this stuff, your body naturally says, ooh, sugar, ooh, fat, salt, I want that. So you cut that down, and then also put taxes in place that would then be applied to wellness programs, just like we do with tobacco.
What has the industry response been to this kind of suggestion?
You know what? They don't like it, it turns
really?
Out.
Really?
In fact, they are circling their wagons as we speak. Most of the attention so far has been on soda taxes, one of which just got defeated in New York. The industry says, look, we have to fight these things. We've got to do everything we can to work together to oppose them. Well, of course, that's what they say. One recent study at Harvard found that if you increased the price of soda, the consumption would fall off precipitously.
David Lazarus is the consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, July 7th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take on the global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. In a third investigation into the so-called Climategate saga in the UK, authorities didn't find anything that would undermine the case for man-made global warming. They've cleared scientists of any wrongdoing, but have criticized them for not being quite so open. The BBC's Roger Harabin is with us from London with an update on this story. Hi, Roger.
Yeah, hi.
Give us a quick reminder of what these scientists were accused of.
Okay, just before Christmas, you may remember, there was a great rumpus in the international media when these scientists were accused of trying to unduly influence the scientific peer review process after their emails were hacked. And it's created really a crisis, not just in climate science, but across the whole of science.
And what's being done about these hacked emails, Roger?
Well, the police were still looking into the hacked emails. You know, there's some question of it being an inside job, some question of it being an outside job, and we still don't know.
Roger, what was the main criticism that that these scientists got?
One criticism refers to a graph which appeared on a publication from the World Meteorological Organization, which showed temperatures rising, and this was a graph which blended together real temperature data with temperature data from tree rings. The panel here said if you look deep into the report, you'd find out all the annotations to that and all the explanation. But actually on the cover, it wasn't very clear, and that was rather misleading. So, and the other comment they make, of course, is a regular one, which another inquiry has made, which is the scientists involved were simply far too defensive with their data. They weren't open, and that science itself has to be revolutionised in this, the age of the blogosphere, to make science more democratically accountable and more transparent on the internet.
The BBC's Roger Harabin joining us from London. Roger, thank you.
Thank you.
At the moment, it's the third largest initial public offering in history. China's agricultural bank raised $19 billion from investors in Hong Kong and Shanghai. But more shares could be sold tomorrow, and if they are, it could set a world record. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, despite the big opening, there are some doubts about the business.
Big investors gobbled up shares of China's ag bank, but a lot of the interest was because of the Chinese government, not the Chinese bank. Victor Shi at Northwestern University says Beijing helps keep banks profitable by keeping deposit rates that banks pay out very low.
Banks usually have a guaranteed spread, and so that's the big upside for any Chinese bank.
But what the state giveth, the state taketh away. Also under government direction, the agricultural bank has to serve farmers in the countryside, not where the easy money is, says William Hess at the advisory firm China Analytics.
It's been a poorly performing institution, and I think expectations should be that realistically it should be post-mediocre performance in the coming years.
Some fear Chinese banks lend massively in the last 2 years and are holding lots of bad loans. But despite today's IPO, the state still owns most shares of the agricultural bank, and investors are betting that the government won't let it fail. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Even before the recession, the state of Michigan was in a deep economic slump. In the city of Grand Rapids, manufacturing was once king, but a lot of its factories have since shut down. So the past few years, that city's been embarking on a new economy. In part one of a two-part series, reporter Jay Field explains.
In the last 10 years, Grand Rapids has lost a third of its manufacturing jobs. Roughly 11% of people here are still out of work. But you wouldn't know it strolling around downtown.
It actually looks different every day when we drive in. A new construction, new chunk of skyline, new cranes.
George Bosniak and I are touring the city on foot. He's with the Right Place, the big economic development agency in town. We head for a hill above downtown. It's called Medical Mile, home to two new cancer centers and a new medical school. John Logie, the former mayor of Grand Rapids, says the city has changed a lot over the years.
When I was running in 1991, I took a pad of paper and I walked the four blocks down there. There were 76 vacant storefronts in those four short blocks.
Logie worked with a group of wealthy local philanthropists to try to revitalize Grand Rapids. First, a $75 million arena was built. Shortly after, Jay Van Andel, one of the co-founders of Amway, walked into Logie's office and said he wanted to build a state-of-the-art medical research foundation. David Van Andel, Jay's son, runs the Van Andel Institute.
That now is attracting more and more investment, as well as more and more people, to an industry that 10 years ago didn't really exist on this side of the state.
David Van Andel expects businesses affiliated with Medical Mile to generate hundreds of badly needed jobs in the coming years. But Paul Isley, an economist at nearby Grand Valley State University, says people who've lost manufacturing jobs face a tough transition as they compete for positions in healthcare.
The skills necessary for those jobs are different. And so there's a lag time between when someone loses their job and when they can retrain, find a job that's available, and get back into another job.
It's a challenge area businesses and universities must address if more local residents are to benefit from the new life sciences industry transforming their city. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, I'm Jay Field for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, a look at some of the obstacles to retraining factory workers. And finally, to help prepare for a new theme park in Shanghai, Disney plans to open about 150 English language schools in China over the next 5 years.
I mean, what better company to teach English than one that invented so many eloquent and articulate characters? In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You know, that was Donald Duck saying, "This is the Marketplace Midday Update."
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.